And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. It's hard to believe we've done this show for 2.5 years and we haven't already gotten to this, but this is the week we talk in detail about Downton Abbey, which premiered this week to a large and excitable audience. And speaking of audiences, they can be awfully hard to please at times, so we'll chat about modes of redemption, the ways that even the most polarizing artists and celebrities can instantly make themselves seem a lot more likable. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I edit movies coverage for the NPR website.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, it's wonderful to see all of you and to be together again.
It is.
So we're going to talk about Downton Abbey. Now, Stephen, I think of you as...
I'm glad you started with me.
...the most rabid Downton Abbey fan I know.
Well, you know, if there's one thing that I love, as discussed on this program before, I love watching prim women in hats.
Yes.
Daffy ants.
Yes.
The British class system.
Yes.
Is really huge.
So you're a big fan of Downton Abbey.
So Maggie Smith is pretty much all three of those things.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I have, truth be told, I have never seen Downton Abbey, and I'm worthless. Yeah. Worthless in this conversation.
Well, that is very unfortunate, and I am trying to figure out whether I have a solution to this problem.
Wait, you know, I see one over your shoulder.
Look around the room.
I think I see a solution, too.
I shall sweep into the room.
Get out of that chair, Stephen Thompson.
Get out of that chair. Man, go downstairs where you belong, with the servants' quarters.
I hear a very familiar voice. Tell us who you are.
I'm Barry Hardiman. I'm a Downton Abbey fan.
And what do you do at NPR?
I am an editor at NPR's Weekend Edition.
And I will tell you, Barry, that on Twitter recently, someone told me that it was time for one of us to get sick and need a week off. Because they needed a Barry Hardiman fix.
That sounds so...
Fortunately, we found a way to invite you without anyone needing to get deathly ill.
And I'm so thrilled to be in the room with all of you at the same time.
It's wonderful.
Like the universe is shaking.
It's wonderful. So you are a Downton Abbey fan.
I am.
So let's establish a little bit of a baseline. Do you like it?
I enjoy it with every fiber of my being. I don't always like it.
Right.
I, in fact, believe that perhaps Julian Fellowes lost his laptop in the bottom of the Thames last year, and then when he pulled it up, something weird happened wherein the Earl of Grantham became someone else for two episodes.
He certainly did.
Yeah, that's true. That is very
which
true.
Which was bizarre. But I still, I mean, even, you know, today, during my son's nap, I indulge in a bit of doubt. And I, you know, it's hard not to laugh at it as well as with it, but I do love it.
How about you, Trey Graham? Are you a Downton guy?
I am a Downton guy. I am the resident fan of costume dramas and tightly laced bodices and that sort of thing. So
I'm
totally
like
down with
this.
And
women in hats.
I absolutely do.
Glenn Weldon, are you Downton guy?
I'm down with Downton, yeah.
That's wonderful.
Because, wow. It is wonderful.
Sure, because, I mean, I think it's safe to say that in the third season, some of the wiring of the show is showing.
Right. Mm.
But I am fine with that, because what is the contract this show makes with its audience? The contract is thus, that at some point in every hour, someone will rush into frame... breathless, and shout something to the effect of, there don't seem to be any glasses laid for the pudding wine. That's why we watch.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
pudding wine,
as other people have been known to point out, someone will also run in with a letter.
Yes, of course.
Pudding wine means dessert wine.
Yeah.
I had a moment there where I thought, pudding wine, like notes of butterscotch?
I know.
No, pretty much all butterscotch.
That sounds like the best port ever.
That's right.
Sold.
Chocolatey notes. Yeah. No, just chocolate.
Yeah. Well, and also at some point, obviously, someone will say something and Maggie Smith will say, oh my, and then say something wonderful.
So
wonderful. And that dichotomy between great emotion in service to things that to a contemporary audience consider trivial is a really sort of intoxicating thing.
Yeah.
It is also the thing that motivates a lot of reality television, if you think about it. People caring very much about things that don't matter.
Yes.
And it's tough to watch this last season, or at least the first two episodes of it, as we did last night, without getting all kinds of Queen of Versailles sort of affinities.
Right.
Just the difference is, of course, that Julian Fellowes, as a member of the aristocracy, wants us to empathize with these people.
And Which is hilarious and adorable.
And adorable.
I think he does, but I guess my feeling about this whole business about saving the house is that the saving the house business is not necessarily something where you're supposed to sympathize with the Earl of Grantham simply because he might lose his house. To me, this season, and we are not here going to spoil anything beyond what's already been on in the U.S., despite the fact that I have seen a bunch more of it. But I think this take on the idea of losing the house is part of a bigger story about Lord Grantham feeling obsolete.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's very much more about the generations and time passing him by and his mm-hmm. relationship with Matthew and things like that are about his sense of creeping obsolescence. It's not the house itself. It's this whole way. I mean, remember, the thing that's remarkable is it's 1920. It's,
as they told us repeatedly.
This world that these people live in, this yes. is not even 100 years ago. These people live in a world that seems preposterously far away. And if you remember what would be going on at this time in other parts of society and in the U.S. and what is good, you know, there's already jazz, you know, there's already jazz and these people are living.
Oh, I wish Maggie Smith were here to put you down about the jazz.
And these people are living like it's, I mean, to me, what makes the story about the house interesting is the relationship to his way of life and the change that he sees in the world.
And British audiences, of course, would read this a little bit differently, this crisis about losing the house, because they would understand at a more organic level what the house and the broader concept of the estate as a mm-hmm, business that mm-hmm. employs a town full of people. Mm-hmm. And they would understand that instinctively. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think an American audience is going to have it explained that the collapse of the estate would be like the collapse of your town's major industry, mm-hmm. right? And all sorts of people would be out of work.
And I think, too, it's interesting. I wonder if this season, now that there's been this outcry and people, obviously, there's a huge American fan base, it seems like they're writing even more mm-hmm. for an American audience. And even to the fact that the only people who are making any sense, like Cora, when she turns around and says, we could just live in a smaller estate. You know, I mean, it's like the Americans are so normal, you know, yeah. whereas, you know, Lady Mary is like the Carrie Bradshaw of Downton.
This is what I think.
Please give me those shoes.
This is what I think is really interesting, is that I think a lot of people assume that you're always supposed to feel deeply for Mary and her concern about the house because Mary has sort of become the romantic heroine, right, in her relationship with Matthew. But remember, Mary was originally awful.
Yeah. Originally?
And she was originally...
She might still be awful.
Right. And that's what... But that's what I'm saying, is that originally she was pretty unambiguously awful.
Oh, I see.
And so I don't in any way assume that Julian Fellowes, in writing the show, assumes Mary is right.
Right. You know, yeah. or has changed, even.
Right. You are meant to think of her as wonderful. You are meant to think of all her demands upon Matthew and her father and everyone as completely correct because mm-hmm. she's the heroine, mm-hmm. which I think is kind of what people sometimes suspect, is that you're supposed to sympathize with her.
The person with the best wardrobe.
I mean, you're supposed to sympathize with her feelings, but I don't think you're necessarily supposed to think she's right.
No, she clearly, in that first two-hour episode that's kicked off the third season, she's making a couple of really tacky choices for someone who's supposed to have all the best manners in the world.
Right. Although Matthew, just a bit of a prig.
Can be, absolutely.
Bit of a prig.
For all the criticism the show has gotten for taking what has been for two seasons the subtext and making it text in every word that comes out of Shirley MacLaine's mouth, mm-hmm. She plays Martha, I think it's interesting because, you know, Forster said, there are flat characters and there are round characters. Mm-hmm. And flat characters exist to delineate the round characters, the mm-hmm. people that we care about. What makes a round character round is the fact that they're capable of surprising you. Flat characters aren't. Flat characters, you can express what they're about in one sentence. Mm-hmm. And Shirley MacLaine's character saves you that trouble because she only says one sentence in the two episodes we've seen so far, which is about how America, things change, and here in England, nothing is all the same. But what that forced Maggie Smith's character to do was to adopt an entirely different, more round characteristic, where mm-hmm. all of a sudden she's in a subservient position. She mm-hmm. wants something. For mm-hmm. two seasons, mm-hmm. she hasn't wanted mm-hmm. something. She's always had the upper hand.
Right.
But she was a flat character. I am wittily and wearily weary of...
Americans.
The new, you know. I want the status quo. And now she's forced to do something. I heard some people criticize the fact that Shirley MacLaine and Maggie Smith didn't get into a big cat fight, didn't mm-hmm. pull hair. I wasn't looking for that. I was looking for something this. Deepen these characters mm-hmm. at this point. The other thing about the show is that it's paced really efficiently. I wouldn't necessarily say well.
No.
But efficiently. In that
head snapped between the wedding and the honeymoon.
Exactly. Yeah. Scenes come on. They've got a lot of different characters
also,
to play with.
I wanted to see some honeymoon, too. Well, I wanted to see that wardrobe. Not even for the reason you think.
Okay, that's a you thing.
Yeah.
But the scene, as soon as a scene's point is reached, it ends. And we move on to a different storyline. And that serves to make the pacing quick, but also it can make the thing, when you look back on an episode, feel a little thin. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Feel a little driven by plot, not mm-hmm. character.
Yeah, that's where it really shows its sort of soap opera backbone.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and the interesting thing is, as this third season started, the story that is not working for me is the same story that wasn't working for me in the second season, which is Bates in prison.
Mr. Bates!
I liked that character so much in the first season when he was in the house with the other servants, when he was sort of a person who had a bunch of mystery and conflict and all this stuff. And I never really cared that much about, like, the, you know, revelation as to his background and all that. But his sort of difficulty forming close relationships, not just the romantic relationship with Anna, but the, you know, his holding himself at a distance from Lord Grantham and other things. That was all interesting to me. This prison thing just completely leaves me cold and has left me cold.
And every time the music starts for it, I mean, literally everybody in the house groans.
The prison theme.
It's like, oh my God, that's like a really bad Law and Order, suddenly.
Right. Because the complications, every plot complication we can see coming, and there's a certain there's a certain reassurance
it's
to that.
It's been
the,
so
the show's
static.
On rails, right? And, and it's reassuring to know where we're going.
Oh, there's another inheritance out there?
Exactly. But the plot complications, we can see the plot complications coming three scenes before they actually drop.
Right.
So that has a feeling of, I know where this is going and I don't want to know where this is going.
Yeah. Although I also just don't, those characters aren't working for me anymore. I mean, it's literally like all of a sudden, all of the stuff that's bright and interesting and fun to look at and interesting to listen to becomes dark and boring
that's
and has
exactly
no chemistry.
Right. That's exactly right.
And even, and again, the wardrobe is
worse. They had such lovely chemistry to me in the first season when she was very dutiful and she was very likable and she was sort of the most level-headed person on that staff, and you could kind of tell that she was sort of the one who understood what everybody was up to and what was happening. Mm-hmm. So you really rooted for her, and you really rooted for them because he was clearly so tormented and all that stuff.
But now all his secrets are out.
Yeah, and it's like so much of the rest of this show moves with this kind of, there's always something going on and stuff. And some of it is repetitive, but there's always new stuff happening. And somebody is always running into the letter and, oh my gosh, and, you know, stamping something with sealing wax. And that's sort of like, the show is kind of hurly-burly in that way. Mm-hmm. Whereas this story, you just sit there being like, still?
You can tell that Julian Robert Fellows is like, still, I got to keep typing this. I'm still going to type
in
it.
Prison, still in prison.
Still in prison.
Mr. Bates. Yeah.
I must keep the lovers apart. That's really what it's about.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of, I nearly threw something at the television when it looked for a moment like we were going to put the wedding off again.
Oh, good God.
I was like, please don't go down that path one more time with these two people.
And there are stories where I think he has lots and lots of ideas for the characters. I think with Matthew and Mary, it's interesting that they kind of did do the wedding right away. And then they had more problems. And they had compatibility issues and some of the same things.
And that's real. That's
and
good.
Some of the same things that were problems for them from the beginning. Her sort of reverence for the house and the estate and everything versus his not came up and was interesting. And he seems to have lots of ideas for them and for that relationship. Whereas Edith, for example.
No ideas.
Poor Juan Edith.
Oh, it just seems like Edith, man.
Yeah. And even, you know,
it's like there's one idea about Edith, which is poor Edith.
Yeah, right. I know. But I also feel that, I mean, Sybil and Branson aren't, I mean, is there any more cardboard character than Ireland still?
I don't you know, you have to think about it.
You
have to think about it in context, though. I mean, this would have been just so much more lively.
But there is no, he has no shades of, he is only that person. There is, he is a
flat character.
At this point in the story, he is a pretty flat character.
Right. And I think she said two things.
He may get less flat.
I gotta say though, I'm still with a show that can make me actually invest in the question of whether someone's dress shirts are going to be discovered.
Oh, well, you know I am.
Well, and who doesn't love the evil gay footman? Is he not the best?
Oh, yes.
He is the best. And in fact, there was a point in my revisiting of other episodes of the series and other parts of the series where I realized that really, in some ways, although the Bates and Anna romance is very swooning, the most intriguing relationship Bates had was with him. This very sort of pulling at each other and very competitive and
sparky.
And they're both competitive, but for different reasons. And I just think Thomas, the gay footman, is just the absolute best thing in the world.
He's great fun to watch. And, you know, the tall new footman isn't so bad.
Yeah.
Oh,
he's tall.
Tall new valet.
Yeah.
Valet
is extremely tall. He is extremely tall. He does seem to have sort of taken the place of the one who died in the war.
He even, I actually
they look a bit alike.
I kind of confused them for a little bit.
And we get we meet a new guy, a new posh sort who slips the Irish guy a Mickey. Redundantly.
Oh,
and,
I loved him.
And, who reads a little gay. Yeah. At least Faye.
Oh, the hot footman.
He and Thomas are perfect for each other.
The rich guy who comes for dinner.
Oh, the rich guy.
Larry
yes,
Gray.
Is that his name?
Larry Gray, who actually sounds like Who Shot J.R. material more than Downton Abbey, like back to the soap opera.
It totally does. Again, you got to love a story that can bring to you that moment where someone stands up and says, "Be silent this minute, sir."
It really does have that charm of just something that American audiences do not watch a lot of as popular entertainment. And we should mention the numbers for this last night. I mean, 8 million people watched this. That's a lot of people. That's a decent audience for a prime
time. That's a gigantic audience for public television.
For public television, it's enormous. Yeah. And, you know, they have not yet found the next the next Downton Abbey. I am sure they're looking.
I bet they are.
I am sure they are wildly looking. Mm-hmm. They have not found it yet, but eventually they're also going to have to solve the problem of the non-simultaneous airings with the UK because those 8 million people do not include the many people who did not watch it live because they had already gotten an illicit download from the UK.
That sounds so dirty.
I got an illicit download from the UK. But it doesn't even count those people because they have not solved that problem yet. Downton Abbey.
I can't wait to see the permutations that come our way. I mean, if this just means a boom of costume dramas, we're as happy as countesses in leather and lace. I mean, lace. That's a new one, though. Countesses in leather and lace.
I wouldn't watch that.
That's mine.
Barry's just invented the next period drama. Wow. Well, among those 8 million people, we're figuring there are probably at least some of you who are listening, so please feel free to come and find us at facebook.com/PCHH. Tell us what you think. Do you like the new season? Please don't spoil everyone. That has happened in a couple of stories already. Please don't spoil everyone if you've already seen a lot of it. But come and talk to us about what you like and, you know, which character you see yourself being.
Which headpiece you see
which
yourself wearing.
Which headpiece you would like to wear.
I know which one I want. Mm-hmm.
Feathers in the eye. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of headpieces that we would like to wear,
And now for the elegant switcheroo.
That's right. Now for the elegant switcheroo, we are going to return Stephen's chair for the moment to Stephen. But we'll see Barry again at the end of the show. Is that all right with you, Barry?
It is. Sorry, my ear's sweated.
Stephen Thompson.
Hey.
I recognize you.
It is good to be back. Talking about something that I theoretically know a single thing about.
Well, you know, Barry's presence, it turned out, was fleeting. And that's
nice try, Hardyman.
That's my massive...
Out of my cold, dead hands.
And that's my great segue to our next topic, because just as fame can be fleeting, that's in part because even fans can be very, very fickle. So we thought it might be fun to explore the idea of redemption, what it takes to get people back on your side if you've lost them or if they're just not entirely too sure about you. Stephen, you seem like the perfect guy to kick off a conversation about redemption.
If there's one thing I love, it's forgiveness of terrible things that people have done. For some reason, I'm a big fan of it.
Wonderful.
But, you know, we've been talking about the idea kind of behind the scenes of what can you do to suddenly go from being somebody that people laugh at, don't like, view askance, into somebody that we embrace. And you had talked about, I think it was Mariah Carey on Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah.
And when Mariah Carey appeared on Jimmy Fallon, what was...
They did an All I Want for Christmas Is You video with the Roots playing on the little toy instruments. They've done a couple of these videos. Well, they did one with Carly Rae Jepsen. Mm-hmm. They did this one. And what it really does is it humanizes her a lot. Because whatever you think of her, and I think she's wildly talented, has always been wildly talented, but she's been subject to a certain amount of speculation about her attitude and diva issues.
Well, and she
stuff
was in
like
Glitter. She, you know, she's been involved in projects that don't make her seem self-aware.
Exactly. And so what this really did was give her a sense that she had a sense of humor about herself and a sense of fun and a sense of spontaneity, which are not necessarily things she's been known for.
Do you think that Jimmy Fallon is unusually suited to walk people through this idea?
I think he is. I think the fact that his show is so much about happiness and upbeat love of everyone, I think it does make a very good place to look likable. just because it's always such a happy, it's kind of a happy world. But
it's
honestly,
it's a rising tide that lifts all.
Yeah. But late night has always been a little like that. If you think back even to Hugh Grant on Jay Leno, that Jay Leno is the place Hugh Grant went after his prostitution arrest, I guess it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he sort of goes on Jay Leno and says this thing about, Jay Leno says, what the hell were you thinking? And everybody laughs. And it's this, he goes on and he's sort of self-effacing and people get over it. And that's always been a big part of what late night does for people is it allows you to have a conversation. David Letterman has sometimes been a very humanizing force for.
Well, and has himself been subject to those interviews.
Right. Well, that's absolutely true. Probably more than any other late night host, Letterman has used his own show for his own redemption after all the stuff came out about the affairs and all that business.
But nobody really remembers what Hugh Grant said on Leno. They remember him being asked the question. They remember the big laugh. And they remember him sort of doing his
stammering
thing. And that's it, because it's about showing up.
Yeah, that's really true. That's really true.
It is
And Mariah Carey doesn't do anything special in that video either. It's the fact that she's there.
The self-effacing is key, I think. Yeah. You know, you can't come on and square your shoulders and try to pretend nothing happened. You know, Mariah wasn't actually trying to make up for anything. She was just playing along nicely. But there's an element of self-effacement in that. Well, sitting down and playing.
There's a humility. There's a humility to it.
Yep. Well, and as much as a self-effacing quality is very attractive to people, I think there's just simply a desire in the audience to get the sense that the person knows what's going on with them.
Yeah.
And wants to reconnect.
That they're not just this reservoir of delusion.
Right.
Who has no idea that they're annoying people or that they're viewed as weird or that they were wrapped up in a prostitution scandal.
Yeah.
You know, there's an idea like, okay, yeah, there's an apology tour going on with Hugh Grant or with David Letterman, but there's also a sense that they understand that they have to redeem themselves a little bit.
Right. That they've come to make it right. And that's a little different. The Mariah Carey thing is more about building your likability as opposed to making up for a specific scandal or incident. And building up your likability is where not only the late night talk shows, but also Saturday Night Live has been so important for so many people. I mean, Anne Hathaway did herself huge favors by being widely seen as a good host on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And sometimes some people who got really well known for drama, if you show up and you're funny, that's sort of how John Hamm got a whole other side of his career.
True that,
was by popping up and on 30 Rock and on places like that and suddenly being funny, which people didn't originally know about him.
Well, and that ties into the idea, another important aspect of this is to come off as good-natured.
Yeah.
To come off as willing to poke holes in your own persona in a lighthearted way. And I think that's what you're getting at with the John Hamm. And it all comes back to the idea of not being too big for your britches. If you can come off as not too big for your britches, the audience wants to forgive most people.
Right.
But you can't, you know, if let's say we're referring to a scandal, you can't go on in complete denial that you ever did anything wrong.
Right.
And the classic example of that would be Charlie Sheen, who has, you know, despite several attempts to sort of round the corner, doesn't necessarily seem to many people that he means it or that he really wants to reconnect.
I don't think he cares at all. I don't think it's important to him at all that people like him or...
I mean, he'd like to have another show. You know, I mean, I know he does, but I mean, when he was fired from Two and a Half Men, there was a sense of he had to go around and kind of make the rounds, but it was in pursuit of resuscitating his career.
Exactly.
And he wasn't able to hide the notes of defiance and contempt.
Right. And because it was, there was a means to an end there. There was a, you felt that he was doing it for a reason. It came off as shallow and fake. A classic example that worked in 1991, Pee Wee Herman was arrested for some very public and very pubic indecency. and he appeared on the VMAs and came out. And what was interesting about that appearance was that he had already left the show. The show was already a thing in the past. He didn't go back and buzz his hair back to Pee Wee Herman levels. He just slicked it back because he had long hair at the time. It was his way of saying goodbye to the Pee Wee Herman character for a long time. He came out and he basically said, heard any good jokes lately? Because for the 3 or 4 months preceding that, there were nothing but
jokes.
Bad, really insensitive, sometimes funny, Pee Wee Herman jokes at his expense. So he came out, did that, And it wasn't something that rehabilitated the Pee Wee Herman character. He left it behind and he kind of went and did other acting for a while.
Yeah.
And lately he's brought it back. But it doesn't, sometimes it's just about acknowledging and moving on.
Well, I actually wrote down in my notes here, go away for a while.
Exactly.
That's very important. Mm-hmm. If it's a big thing, that's very important.
And you, Linda, wrote an essay, what was it, months ago about John Edwards.
Yes, I
and
did.
How, like, your ultimate advice to John Edwards was just go away.
Yeah.
Leave us alone. Mm-hmm. Don't try to redeem yourself. Just leave.
That's the thing that works the best.
And it doesn't mean go away forever.
Right. And there is a difference between things that people truly believe are bad mm-hmm. and things where, I think with Paul Rubens, I think people fairly quickly reached the conclusion that that was a pretty stupid thing to lose your job over in the
right.
first place. And I'll tell you somebody else that happened to was Vanessa Williams when she lost right. Miss America for there being some nudie pictures of her floating around. I think a lot of people concluded that was a pretty dumb thing for her to get in trouble for in the first place. And so when she emerged later and she was a singer and yep. she was an actress, people were kind of ready.
Yeah.
And she gave them a little, she gave a little break. She was quiet for a while. Mm-hmm. And then she shows up and people are ready. And partly that's because when you give people the opportunity to reflect on a scandal, sometimes they stop and think,
why was that a scandal?
Why were we upset about that again? And I think that's part of why recently when Fred Willard
yes.
was in a kind of Pee Wee Herman-y kind of situation, I think that sort of came and went. Now, he lost his position on a show he was doing, but I think that in terms of his persona, nobody really cares. I don't
right.
think he had to serve much of a sort of get out of the spotlight.
Well, and he's still Fred Willard. It's not like he was...
Exactly.
He's
exactly.
peripheral to the spotlight.
Exactly. I think it partly depends on the nature of what you do, how hard it is to come back.
One thing that Vanessa Williams and, say, Richard Nixon had in common was that they went away for a while and then delivered when they came back.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to come back, you gotta deliver the goods, right?
It's the old Vanessa Williams, Richard Nixon theory. It's a classic. Mm-hmm. It's a classic.
There's kind of a cottage industry that helps this with certain people. The Funny or Die
yeah,
series videos. I mean, it worked with Rebecca Black. Rebecca Black came out with her Friday video. It was seen by everybody as very self-indulgent and crazy. But she is a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a certain amount of goodwill already there.
Well, when you think about how much scorn was heaped on that
exactly.
kid for very little good reason.
For just being thoughtless. For just being a kid who had lots of money to throw around, apparently. But she comes and she does a video on Funny or Die, and it wins her a lot of goodwill mm-hmm. back. It's that simple. They've done it with other celebrities. It hasn't always worked.
I was going to bring up the Funny or Die example of John Mayer, where John Mayer did a bit on Funny or Die where he was sort of lampooning his persona as a spoiled, vacuous jackass. And it did seem like it was going to go a long way toward resuscitating that. And then he gives another interview in which he's a vacuous, horrible jackass.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You always have to stop doing it. Like, you have
yeah.
your redemption thing, but you also really have to stop doing the thing, especially if it's a part of your image that comes from something genuine that people have observed about you.
Yeah.
The other thing that occurred to me that seems to me to be much more a part of this cycle than it used to be is playing yourself. If you are a celebrity, the act of playing yourself. Not necessarily for the redemption angle as far as coming back from a scandal, but it really has the capacity to add a layer of likability that I think little else can accomplish for people who seem at the time to be hopelessly uncool.
Mm.
And that's sort of what James Vanderbeek did,
yeah,
is
exactly.
that when he started playing himself and acknowledging this Dawson's Creek business, all of a sudden he became cool.
Yeah.
I cannot think of another way in the world that guy could have become cool. Like, how did that guy become cool? This is how. He
right.
made fun of himself.
Yep.
And the same thing really happened. People don't remember this now, but remember, Neil Patrick Harris
yep. was just
Blue
say.
Hauser for a really
say.
Long time before he played himself in the Harold and Kumar movies, and now he's like the coolest person ever. And it's partly because he came out with this recognition that he had a certain image. He made fun of that image. It's been done by a variety. It's been done by Matt LeBlanc on episodes. It's a little different, but it's been done by Will Wheaton on The Big Bang Theory.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Will Wheaton plays this really funny, evil version of himself on The Big Bang Theory. Now, Will Wheaton was already cool, pretty much,
right.
and to the people who
Certainly
know who he
people,
is,
yeah.
he's already cool. But there's a sort of irresistible good nature in playing yourself
right.
that I think very little else can quite match.
I guess another facet of this that I wanted to get into slightly was the idea of the comeback in general. Mm-hmm. And what so often fuels that is kind of this taking advantage of the bedraggled nature of your reputation and then channeling that into like a dramatic role mm-hmm. that seizes on that. And of course, Mickey Rourke is the mm-hmm. first person who popped in my head where mm-hmm. he's playing a role in The Wrestler that is keying off the fact that he's messed up his face. And,
he lucked into exactly the right part, among other things.
But the latest example of that, and it's a movie that we'll certainly talk about more when we get into our Oscars coverage, mm-hmm. is Bradley Cooper. Mm-hmm. That Bradley Cooper has this sort of dramatic role in Silver Linings Playbook where all of a sudden you see a lot of these initial reviews that are like, Bradley Cooper is surprisingly effective. As,
yeah.
You know, but now it's...
That's a very different thing. That's sort of redeeming yourself from mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. thinking that you're limited.
Right.
Which is a little bit different. Because the interesting thing about Silver Linings with that particular guy is that you see this him play this part and people say, oh, you know, I'm used to thinking of him as this slick douchebag.
Yeah.
But my initial exposure to Bradley Cooper and a lot of people's initial exposure to Bradley Cooper was on Alias, where he was the dork. Which, of course, if you look at him, he's a Hollywood dork, right?
Right.
But he was the friend. He was the one who didn't get the girl. He was the one who sort of pined away and didn't get the girl. And so for me, what was funny was seeing him become the guy in The Hangover mm-hmm. and all those other weird things he did, where it was like, I'm a slick guy, because I sort of thought, he's the nerdy guy, sort
of. He's the guy who gets the boy.
Yeah.
Without American yeah. Summer. Yeah.
But it's also just the notion, getting back to the idea of redemption, of playing against type. Mm-hmm. You know, as much as you can benefit from playing yourself and showing that self-awareness, the ability to do something entirely unexpected right. of you kind of goes back to that point of self-awareness and just that right. lack of delusion. People want to see a lack of delusion.
And that's the other element, I think, of the Neil Patrick Harris thing, was he went the opposite way and it became mm-hmm. farce and funny and right. things like that. And so it showed a different side. Anyway, we would always be interested in hearing your thoughts about redemption. So come and find us on Facebook or at the blog and let us know your favorite redemption stories, what you think are the most effective ways for people to come back or increase their likability. And we're always happy to hear your ideas. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
I follow James Walcott, the writer, very funny writer on, he has a Vanity Fair blog that's very good. Mm-hmm. I follow him on Twitter. And this week he linked to a piece that was the cover story of the New York Times Magazine. It's a profile of the writer George Saunders. Mm-hmm. And it's called, George Saunders has written the best book you'll read this year. And when Walcott linked to it, he linked to it by saying, I like the work of George Saunders, but this seems a bit much. Mm-hmm. And so I went into it. That's how I started reading this article. And it's around the fact that his new collection of short stories called The 10th of December comes out this week. I was sort of understanding where Walcott was coming from as I started reading this article. Mm-hmm. And then I hit this passage. You read Saunders' stories and you feel known, if that makes any sense. Or possibly even woolier, you feel as if he understands humanity in a way that no one else quite does, and feel comforted by it. And I got to that point and it was like, boom, Walcott's wrong, this guy's right, because this is exactly the feeling I get from reading George yeah. Saunders. Cast your mind back to 1994. A young tow-headed Glenn is in an MFA program for fiction in the heart of the American prairie, feeling imposter syndrome like you would not believe, feeling like some massive fraud has been perpetrated on this institution, and I am here incorrectly, and it's just a matter of time before somebody finds out. And looking for people who feel that same way in the program, because I know that they will be my friends. And trying to avoid those in the program who feel like they have inherited the mantle of the American literary tradition and they should be there. I read the story in an issue of Harper's in 1994, which had been reprinted from the Indiana Review. It's a story by this author I never heard of before called George Saunders. It was a story called Isabel, and you can find it in his first short story collection, Civil War Land and Bad Decline. At the time in that program, there were a lot of straight white dudes doing the Raymond Carver shtick. Uh-huh. He'd been dead for years, but they were still doing the Raymond Carver uh-huh. shtick. A lot of fiction about poor, sensitive, sad, boozy, straight white dudes going through a divorce as we've mentioned before, rainwater fills an ashtray on the picnic table outside their trailer. A lot of that. And to be fair, this story, Isabel, starts off in a voice that felt very similar to that, uh-huh. but it goes to this amazing, quiet, funny, assured, and that was the key, a really assured voice that I hadn't heard before. And to say that the ending of it, the final couple paragraphs, are breathtaking, literally breathtaking, I gasped when I got to the end of this. And I started talking to other people in the program, and everybody in the program, even the ones who felt they really belonged there, recognized that this was special and this was the start of something. So I recommend that article in the New York Times Book Review, but I really recommend, I don't know what, I've read several stories in 10th of December when they were published in magazines. I'm sure it's a great collection, but I want to send people to Isabel, the story in Civil War Land of Bad Decline by George Saunders.
Wonderful.
Wow.
I enjoyed that very much. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
I've got nothing quite that rapturous, but I am anticipating the arrival of a little film called Struck by Lightning, which is the writing and directorial debut of Chris Colfer, the kid who plays Kurt Hummel on Glee. Not just because I think it's fun that he's moving in that direction of his life, but also because it's got people in it like Christina Hendricks from Mad Men and Allison Janney, who makes everything perfect. So.
That is true. So that's making you happy.
Yes, indeed.
Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
For the first, five, 6 days of 2013, I watched a movie a day.
You're awesome.
At that pace, if I keep it up the entire year, I will have watched a movie a day. But I've been trying to get my Oscar prep in. Because every year, the Oscars roll around in late February.
We kind of beef up your prep every year. You're getting tougher every year.
Yeah, pretty soon I'm going to be doing that Oscar death race where I see absolutely every movie that's nominated, even like Transformers, Turn Off the Dark. But I wanted to get my Best Picture watching done early this year because what ends up happening inevitably is they announce the Best Picture nominees. I won't have seen seven of them. And then I spend a weekend that I could otherwise spend, you know, preparing for South by Southwest or, God forbid, spending time with my family. And I spend it, like, cramming, you know, through Best Picture nominees. So in a period of, I did take one day off. So in a period of 6 days, I watched Moonrise Kingdom, Silver Linings Playbook, Beasts of the Southern Wild, Life of Pi, and Lincoln. And what is making me happy, besides that sort of smug satisfaction that drives all my joy, is that I liked all of them. I wasn't necessarily over the moon for all five of them, but the fact that I have been watching all these movies that are very likely to be nominated for Best Picture, and throw in Argo, which I've seen, and throw in The Master, which I've seen, unlike last year, I didn't sit there with my arms folded through any of them.
That's wonderful.
And so kind of taking stock of what's a pretty remarkable year for movies.
Oh, yeah. It's been a solid year for movies. Next thing you know, you're going to read a book.
You know what? It's just around the corner. I can feel it.
At this rate, you are going to start reading. It's just going to shock us all. All right. Well, I think everyone who comes on the show gets to tell us something that's making them happy. So I'm going to drag Barry Hardiman back into Stephen's chair. Barry Hardiman.
Hello.
I'm so glad you came back to sit in Stephen's chair.
I was cowering in the corner.
Yeah. What is making you happy this week? Anything?
Well, I will say this. I have not seen it yet, but Justified returns tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Something that's making me really happy. And this is the way that Stephen Thompson and I sort of fell in love. Patton Oswalt is going to be a character on it. And many, many moons ago, we sat in a search engine optimization course, looked at each other and said, do you like Patton Oswalt? Yes, yes. And the rest is history. But anyway, so Patton Oswalt on a show I already love with Timothy Oliphant and the amazingly scooper-upper Walton Goggins playing Boyd Crowder. He is just so charismatic. It is absurd.
Yes. Scooper-upper. Explain that to me.
That's what happens when you can't find the word for charismatic.
I see. Okay. Continue.
Downton. He is all so charismatic. It is a great show. All of these wonderful characters, wonderfully written, fun to watch, anachronistic, but still, you know. And you know, I have to say, it gets better every season, and I think that Graham Yost in the last season really sort of found his groove, and so I'm really looking forward to seeing what gems he has for me this time around.
That is a good choice. I cannot. Timothy Oliphant's hat is makes everyone happy every week. So here is what is making me happy this week. I have two main things that I want to mention. One of them is that NPR did an interview on Weekend Edition with Bob Dureau, who...
I booked that.
Yeah? Good
for
you.
That was me. I found him. I booked him. I'm sorry.
Good for you. No.
That was... Yeah.
Who did the music for Schoolhouse Rock.
Yep.
And did some of the singing for Schoolhouse Rock. And Schoolhouse Rock is 40 years old. Now, if you have listened to our Barry special episode in which we talked about things for kids... you know that we talked about Schoolhouse Rock and my deep, deep love of Schoolhouse Rock. And the thing that you get from listening to this interview with Bob Dureau, or the thing I got from it, is not only that he's just terribly engaging and is lovely to listen to, but they played some of these songs and you think, those are great little songs. That's mm-hmm. that's part of why they have endured. They played a little bit of Three is a Magic Number. That's just a great song. It's just catchy and sweet. So it was really, really good to hear those songs again. So I recommend that everybody dig up the Weekend Edition interview with Bob Dureau. And thank you, Barry, for that idea.
And may I say, he's 90.
Yeah. Wow.
He's 90. I had the pleasure of booking him, so I got to talk to him on the phone a lot mm-hmm. while he was driving back from New York. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I said, what were you doing in New York? What does anyone do in New York? Having some fun with my wife. I mean, I'm not kidding. And he's 90 years old. Yeah. He can still sing beautifully. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean,
he
we
sang
should
with
all
Rachel Martin.
Be
yeah.
so lucky.
It was a really charming interview. And I thank you for booking it, Barry.
You're very welcome.
It was wonderful. The other thing is, just very briefly, right now, many of my television critic friends are in the middle of press tour, winter press tour out in California. I don't go in the winter, typically. But my friends are out there, and I had to highlight my favorite joke of the week, which actually was not tweeted. It was said in a session, but everyone else tweeted it, which is that my friend Dan Feinberg, who works at HitFix, asked the producers of the new show Bates Motel, which is what you would think. It's about Bates Motel. It's that story. Asked them, should we essentially think of the show as How I Stuffed My Mother? Which... truly, when I read that joke, I just thought, that's just wonderful.
That's efficient comedy, that is.
It really, really made me laugh. And I just, now I will never be able to see that show without thinking how right. I stuffed my mouth.
Well played.
Anyway, so that was my other thing making me happy this week is that joke, which, as you can tell, still makes me laugh, mm-hmm. even now. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Barry Hardiman at B Hardiman, H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. That's all one word. You can also follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. And you can finally follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are listening to right now. So thanks to everybody, especially Barry, for being here this week.
Yay. Especially Barry.
Thanks.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.